Yesterday, we diagonalized the quantum XY model, and we arrived to a form of our Hamiltonian that was the sum over k of some energies that depend on k, and these are the excitations over the ground state. D dagger k d dagger. So you see these are plus a constant. So you see these are operators that create fermionic excitations above the ground state with energy lambda k. And this energy lambda k was found to be, as a function of the parameters of our Hamiltonian, the square root of cosine of 2 pi k over n minus h square plus h square sine square 2 pi k over n. Nk is a quantized number. Okay? So gets the values from 1 to capital N, or from minus n over 2 to plus n over 2, depending how you're labeling your momentum. Okay, so these are the excitations. And it's also worthwhile. Well, no, let me do that later. So, because right now we have defined our critical points as the points in the parameter space, that in this case is h eta, in which the system becomes gapless, we are looking for the solutions of lambda k going to zero. Okay? Well, I don't need this. Lambda k going to zero. Now, let's first start the case of the so-called, so we are looking for solutions of this equation. Let's first look at the case of the so-called XX criticality. That is when eta is equal to zero. So let me start drawing the phase diagram. Here I have eta. Here I have my external field H. You know that eta equal 1 is the so-called Ising model. Okay, but now, right now we are looking at the line eta equal 0. Okay, so this line. And therefore, if eta is equal to zero, our excitations lambda k are the absolute value of cosine of 2 pi k over n minus lambda. Right? My H, sorry. I call it lambda minus. Sorry.
How it's cosine of the 2 pi k and then minus h. The h is not inside the argument.
Oh, sorry. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, that's important. So lambda k being equal to zero means that you are looking for solutions to this equation. Okay. Where h is any number on this line. Now, you also see that there is a solution of this equation only, and this is an absolute value, so I have plus and minus h. So, I have a solution only if h is between plus 1 and minus 1. Okay, so this plus 1 This is minus 1. Okay. Now, I have a real number h, and these numbers are right now, they are quantized. Okay. So I'm only picking a few real numbers on this line. This means that basically the probability of having a solution is 0. So let me simplify and say, you know, this equation doesn't have solution unless we go to the thermodynamic limit. Then this becomes a continuous variable, and it has always a solution in this interval. So you see why we say that these excitations can become gapless only in the thermodynamic limit, and in this case, all this line is a critical line. And this is called XX criticality. Okay. Now, when h is different from, when eta is different from 0, okay, then we see that in the thermodynamic limit, this object goes to 0 because the sign of this number goes to 0 when n is very large. Okay, so this goes to 0. And now we have additional solutions that are this cosine being equal to plus 1 and minus 1. So these are also two critical lines. Okay, so this is the first die. The other thing I want to say is a comment on the structure of the ground state. So the ground state is, let me call it G, is the vacuum of these operators. However, we know that these operators are related to the operators before the Bogoliubov transformation by this expression, cosine theta k over 2 ck minus ie to the 2i phi sine theta k over 2 c dagger minus k, where the angle theta k is defined by the relationship epsilon k, which is this one, here I made this mistake, epsilon k, so let me call this number epsilon k square, so cosine theta k is epsilon k over lambda k. Okay, so this is the relationship. So it's a simple exercise, you can just do it by inspection, that if I write a G in terms of the CK as the tensor product over every K of cosine theta K over 2, 0k, 0 minus k. So this is for every k, so we have two possible momenta that are positive k and negative k, and this means, oh, I do not have any fermion with these two momenta. And these are the fermions in the CK space. Okay, so there are 0K is annihilated by this operator. So these are the Bogoliubov particle. plus I to the e to I phi sine theta k over 2, one fermion with momentum k and one fermion with momentum minus k. Okay. So the same, you just try that if you apply dk on this state, you indeed find that it's annihilated. Now, the form of this state is very interesting because it's the tensor product of pairs, okay? Of pairs of states that have momentum k and minus k. Depending on the context, for instance, in superconductivity, these pairs are Cooper pairs. Or when we are talking about in quantum field theory, they are particle antiparticle pairs because they have opposite momenta. And the interesting thing is that each of these pairs is not in a tensor product. So I have the tensor product of many pairs, but the state of this pair, is an entangled state. You see, it's an arbitrary superposition of 0, 0 plus 1, 1. So it's not in itself a factorized state. So we will, I don't know how much theory of entanglement you already know, but in next week we will do quite a bit of it. And you probably already know that when you have an entangled state, if I only look at one part of the system, this pure state looks mixed, is mixed, the partial state of a pure entangled state. So this is a very interesting fact because the total state of the system is the tensor product of many particles. Now imagine that I can only observe those of positive momentum, then I would have a state that is very mixed. Okay. And as I anticipated yesterday, that is a simple example of how you can have a thermal radiation from a pure state of particles depending on who is observing, because the Bogoliubov transformation is a change of reference frame. Okay. Yeah?
I was just wondering if you could go back to this. I don't think I understand the thing. So we're trying to see when our lambda k is 0. You're going to have the cosine be plus or minus h. Just underneath where you had n going to the thermodynamic limits.
Yeah.
But shouldn't it be just plus h? Am I missing something here?
Yeah, so in the thermodynamic limit, that cosine is identical, it goes to 1, right? Mm-hmm. So if h is 1, that square goes to 0. In the thermodynamic limit, it can go to 1 and minus 1. So h can be 1 and minus 1.
H wasn't a positive parameter in our model?
Yeah, no, that's correct. But when I presented the model, I wrote H is a positive parameter. But actually, when we diagonalized it, We didn't use that.
Okay.
And in fact, you also you can also diagonalize it for negative h.
Okay.
Okay. Good. Okay. So very good. So at this point, we have defined our quantum phases as patterns of symmetry breaking. And quantum phase transitions are signaled by the disappearance of this gap. Okay? And the reason why we think that this is a good definition of quantum phase transition is because we mimicked the classical definition. We said, hey, in classical statistical mechanics, phases are domains of an analysis of the free energy. In the quantum case, the free energy becomes the energy density, so I'm looking for non-analyticity of the ground state energy, because it becomes the energy density in the ground state. And therefore, that's and we say, hey, when delta goes to zero, I should expect that my ground state energy becomes non-analytic. And with that, a series of interesting behaviors like like symmetry breaking, like the appearance of long-range order, which means that the correlation length diverges, and all these things that we have described. However, here we have several problems. First of all, the definition of phases as domains of analyticity of F is good in classical mechanics, in classical statistical physics, because all the expectation values of observable quantities depend on F. Right? There are always some derivative with respect to some parameter of F. So you see, if this is not analytic, then this is not analytic, which means, oh, then it has a different behavior depending on the parameter. For instance, it has a divergent derivative. But in quantum mechanics, observables, expectation values of observables, are given by the wave function. So it is not very clear what is the relationship between the ground state energy and the ground state wave function. And in principle, there is none. Right? Because when I write an Hamiltonian in its spectral resolution, these are the energies and these are the projectors onto the corresponding eigenstates. You know, I can choose the ground state energy and this vector independently, plus orthogonal terms. So it is not very clear what is the relationship. Of course, there must be some relationship because they are the eigenvalue and the eigenstate of the same matrix, which is the Hamiltonian. So we feel the need of understanding the definition of quantum phase more in terms of the wave function. So this is the first remark I wanted to make. The second remark is more technical, and it is this. What happens if my gap closes And so I have this domain of an analyticity, then I have this other domain of an analyticity, but the symmetry is the same. Could happen. We have not ensured that this happened. Also, we are not sure, so we have seen some examples like the Ising model or the quantum XY model in which the closure of the gap, for instance, we have seen this perturbation theory, and you could remake these calculations exactly now that you have the exactly diagonalized form. The closure of the gap signals a divergence of the correlation length. But does it have to be the case? So we've seen this in some examples, right? So we don't know very well what is the relationship between the closure of the gap and the divergence of the correlation length. All we have seen is that in some examples that are very important, like those where symmetry breaking is involved, this happens. So as you can see, these remarks all point in one direction, which is symmetry breaking the only way a quantum phase can change? Do we change a quantum phase just because we change the way of breaking the symmetry of the ground state? Or there are other forms of order? Because the closure of the gap is linked to this critical phenomena in the case of symmetry breaking. We don't know if there is some other phenomenon if we would still have this behavior. So in order to address this question, we decide to revisit our notion of what a quantum phase is. Okay? So now that we have accumulated some knowledge of what a quantum phase is when we are dealing with symmetry breaking, now let's step back from this definition a little bit. And we try to come up with something that is in principle more general, that is not so closely tied to symmetry breaking. And of course, whatever we come up with must still work in the case of symmetry breaking. So the idea is, remember our initial discussion. Our initial discussion is that quantum phases should be some equivalence class. It means that we collect in some ensemble quantum states that have all something in common, and then another phase is another ensemble with another equivalence. So they're equivalent because they have something else in common. And so far, this concept worked very well because we were indicating as the important thing that states can have in common is their symmetry. But now I want to go beyond this paradigm, right? So I want to find a general way to look for things that states may have in common, not knowing what they are. So one possibility could be this. Imagine that I find a way of determining how different two quantum states are. And so here I have a family of states, and between one quantum state and another quantum state, there is some distance. Look, here, I'm not talking about the distance in real space. I'm talking about the distance in the Hilbert space. Now I would like this distance to be really something that is like in differential geometry, because I want to have a notion of two states that are very close to each other. So you see, one thing that could happen is that this state is actually very different from this one. However, I can connect them by series of intermediate states that are very, very close to each other. Okay. So although the state is changing smoothly. Okay, so this is an interesting idea. I can define an equivalence class in this way. Now imagine now I find another ensemble of states that also can be all connected smoothly by some path, meaning that I have some metric, as I said, such that is well behaved, everything is continuous, like in a differentiable manifold, like in general relativity, right? A real metric tensor, a Riemannian metric. Imagine I can do that. And now imagine that this state and this state, although maybe to transform this state in this state, I have to do very little. I will explain what I mean by very little. Imagine that I cannot connect them with a short path. In other words, whatever my metric tensor is, here is blowing up. I have a singularity. Then this could tell me, oh, you say, all these states have something in common, that in some equivalence class I can deform them smoothly one in the other. But not, and here I can do that, but I cannot go across. This definition, if we can make it rigorous, would also work in the case of symmetry breaking. So all the states in the paramagnetic phase can be connected adiabatically. Why? How many of you have done the adiabatic theorem in quantum mechanics? Okay, so you all know that I can deform my Hamiltonian very slowly, and then my state would stay in the ground state if I do it very, very slowly. So in this way, for instance, I am in my Ising model, say I have my parameter g, I change g in this phase very slowly, and I can transform my ground state from g, oh sorry, my ground state from psi 0 of g1 here to psi 0 of g2 here, and I can connect them. And what is the condition for this to be possible in the adiabatic theorem, which is also this condition basically defines what it means very slowly. So the time I use to do that must scale like what?
Inverse of the energy gap.
Great, the inverse of the energy gap. Now you see that within this phase, by definition of a phase, is gap. Right? There is a gap, so I can do that. And of course, I can do it in this other phase. There is a gap, so I can adiabatically deform one state in the other. Of course, I will always make some error, but I can make this error as small as I want if I go slowly enough. But if the gap closes, no matter how slow I go, I can't. So I cannot connect the two states. I cannot go from this ground state to this other ground state by just deforming my Hamiltonian. Okay. So So you see, in this case, it's the closure of the gap signals the failure of the adiabatic deformation. And I want to generalize this concept to some distance between quantum states. And when this metric tensor blows up, then that should be a quantum phase transition. And now you see that if I manage to go on with this definition to make it rigorous, I have not used some specific property of the state like symmetry. And if it so happens that this metric tensor blows up when the gap closes, now I understand why the closure of the gap is important. But maybe I can also see if there are cases where the closure of the gap actually doesn't count. Very good. So this is our program. So we need to understand what is a distance between quantum states. And there are many definitions that are, for instance, used in quantum information of distances between quantum states. But we have to bear in mind that we don't want just any distance. We want something that can be made differential and that can become a metric tensor, right? Because we want to do that thing. Okay. So let's try to understand what is the distance between quantum states. And you know, there is this very instructive, beautiful paper by Wouters that has taught me so much, this paper, about actually the meaning of quantum mechanics. So instead of just giving you a definition of a distance between quantum states, we will construct it heuristically following Wouters. And in this process, we actually will understand many things about quantum mechanics. I dare to say also about the foundations of quantum mechanics. Okay, so the way we can go about this is the following. In some sense, a quantum state is a probability distribution, right? Because we have a quantum state phi, this is the amplitude of some quantum state, and you know that this is the probability density of finding the particle at the point x, right? So in some sense, it is a probability distribution. So we can approach this problem with the distance between quantum states starting from a simpler problem, which is, what is the distance between two probability distributions, okay? And then we try to adapt it to the case of quantum states, because the way quantum states are probability distributions is a bit subtle. Okay. Okay, so imagine I have two probability distributions, Px and Qx. So these are positive numbers that sum to one. And I want to find the distance between them. So one definition is the so-called classical, because these are just probability distributions, trace distance, which is 1/2. The 1/2 is there so that this distance is normalized. Just the sum over all my events of the difference between the probabilities. So that's why it's called trace. Trace means sum. This is a good distance because it is symmetric and it obeys also the triangular inequality, so it is symmetric. However, it's very it's not very easy to deal with and make it a differential thing. So for we will not use it, and we'll do it in another way. But then we will see what are the connections with this object here. Oh, let me also comment that this thing has a very interesting operational meaning, that is this. So imagine I have an ensemble of events S, okay? And I want to compute what is the probability for a certain event that comes from S to happen. This probability is, of course, the sum over all the events in S of Px. And I can compute what is the distance, the difference between the probability of an event in S to happen according to the probability distribution Px and the same probability for this other probability distribution. So you see, this distance depends on what is S, or what subset of events I have chosen. Now, there is a very interesting theorem that says that this distance here, the trace distance, is the max over all the S's of this one. OK, so let's make an example. Imagine we are playing poker, and we have two decks. The first deck says that this probability is 1 over 52 for all the for all the cards. But the other deck is, let me see what I did. -152, it's slightly less than 152 if x are not aces. And 152 plus 12 epsilon when x's are aces. Okay. If you sum over all of this, you will see it's 1. Okay, so this is a different probability distribution. And let's say that my ensemble of events are having a full house. Okay, so there are many configurations, x's, that give you a full house. Now, I might be playing with these two decks, and if I only look at the frequency of full houses, I might not get upset. You know, I might be okay. I might not notice. However, if I look at the frequency of getting four aces, that's when I reach for my gun, right? Because I realize that one of the decks is biased. So you see, so we introduce a notion of the best discriminating measurement that we can make on a system in order to discriminate two probability distributions. OK, let's leave this aside. We will go back to the trace distance later. And then let's look at another one, another way of measuring distance between probability distributions, which is the following. First of all, consider this function, which is called fidelity, the fidelity between two probability distributions, which is the sum of the square root of px qx. OK. This is called fidelity. Let me give this definition, and then let's see how this thing will come up. So imagine we are playing a game with the two coins that have a probability of heads and tails that are 1 and 1 minus p, and the other one is weighed in a different way, is q and 1 minus q. And I can make a certain number of measurements, and I ask, how can I distinguish these two coins? So what you know is that if this is the distribution of my outcomes, and this is the distribution of my other outcomes from the other tail, so from the other coin, if this quantity, this distance, is larger than the sum of these two things, then I will not be able to distinguish. So basically, my criterion for not being able to distinguish these things is that if p minus q is smaller than these standard deviations, then I will not be able to distinguish the two probability distributions. Okay, but what is this standard deviation? For a coin, is p times 1 minus p over the number of experiments that I make, square root. Okay. So now imagine that my p and q are very close in trace distance, the distance that I gave before. If they are very close in trace distance, then delta p is very similar to delta q. So my criterion of indistinguishability becomes being smaller of 2 delta p. Okay, so now this is interesting. Because now I can say, so imagine now that I have two probability distribution. So let me put them on a line, p and q. And I look at all intermediate probability distributions. Right? Imagine that I deform continuously this number p in this number q. And here I have some discrete intervals to delta p, such that if the two probability distributions fall in this interval, then they cannot be distinguished because of this criterion. So I could say, oh, look, my distance between p and q is the number of indistinguishable probability distributions that are in between. Sorry, the number of distinguishable probability distributions that are in between. So this is sort of my atomic distance between probability distributions. Okay. So if I'm actually changing this parameter continuously, then I want to say, okay, so my distance is the integral between p and q in dp. Dp is this parameter that I'm changing continuously over this, right? Okay, 2 delta p. So if I plug in the numbers at this point, I have, okay, so it is delta p, this object, so I have here the 2 square root of p times 1 minus p, and then I have something that scales with the square root of n. Of course, the number of intermediate probability distributions depends on the number of trials that I have, because I'm making these intervals finer.
What's the meaning of dp?
The dp is the differential of the parameter p that I'm changing.
I mean, the meaning of delta p.
Is the is the standard deviation, which is given by this formula for this probability distribution, square root of p times 1 minus p over square root of n.
P is both the distribution and the parameter that you're changing along.
As you can see, this probability distribution is parameterized by p. There's only one number. So I'm going from p1, instead of using p and q, let me call them p1 and p2. And then there is a parameter p that is interpolating between p1 and p2, right? Just this number defines the whole probability distribution. Because this is a very simple probability distribution. Okay.
Because this is coupon distribution, why there's a wide of your experiment. For me, it's a two-point distribution, right? Why there's... But the Dargraph is a smooth distribution.
Yes, I understand, but this is the probability of getting k tails with n trials.
Oh, I see.
Even if you have binary variables, the sum of stochastic variables in the end always gets something like that. Okay. Yeah, sorry, I didn't say that. Okay. All right. So you see, we have a scaling with the square root of n, which is just because we are changing our unit of measure. So if we want to do something that does not depend on this unit of measure, we should normalize this distance in this way. So this is what I have. Okay. At this integral, if you do it, is the arc cosine of the square root of pq plus 1 minus p, 1 minus q. Okay. Now, this example can be generalized to a more sophisticated probability distributions. Yes?
So I don't quite understand. First, you said that p1 minus p2, the distance between them should be smaller than 2 delta p. And
right. So this means that 2 delta p, so if two probability distributions have p and q within 2 delta p, then they are the same. I cannot say they are different. So I can say that there are two different probability distributions if the distance between p1 and p2 is 2 delta p. And now I'm asking, between p1 and p2, how many different distinguishable probability distributions there are is this length over the number of these over the size of the tick, right? And you know, if I make this finer and finer, it becomes an integral, and I get this. In the end, I get this. So if now I have a probability distribution that is px, okay, and another probability distribution that is qx, and I redo all of this, I actually get to a formula that is just the generalization of this to many outcomes. And it is that the distance between p and q is given by the arc cosine of the square root. You see, what is this? It's p1, q1, plus p2, q2, plus P3 Q3. Which is the fidelity, this thing that I introduced here. Okay. So it is the arc cosine of the fidelity. So this is an interesting way of computing the distance between two probability distributions. Classical probability distributions. Yes.
Isn't the fidelity the sum of the square roots and the square root of the sum? Which one is which?
Yes. Is the sum of the square roots? Yes. Sorry. Thanks. So also my previous formula was wrong. It was the sum of the of those two square roots. Okay. Good. So this is the distance between two probability distributions, normal classical probability distribution. Okay. So now let's go back to our quantum states. And for the time being, let me talk just about pure quantum states. And we ask, in what sense a quantum state, psi 1, gives us a probability distribution? When, so I give you this state, this cat. How do you get a probability distribution from a state? What is that you do with the state that returns you a probability distribution?
Decompose it to eigenstates.
Yes, so what you do is that you make a measurement, right? So you measure some observable, A, that has some spectral resolution in terms of its eigenstates. So let me call them PIA. PIA. And now the probability of the outcome I, when I measure this state, sorry, when I measure A in this state, is given by the modulus square of psi 1 phi I A, which is also the trace of this density matrix. Notice that this probability depends explicitly on A, right? Because these are the eigenstates of A. What happens if I measure something different? Now this is where things become very interesting, because actually, when I am in classical physics, how do I compute probabilities? I have my variables in the phase space, right? Instead of having the Hilbert space, I have the phase space. Each coordinate here is called PQ, is 6n coordinates. It's a point in the phase space, is the collection of all positions and all momenta. I'm not using P and Q because there are too many PQs around. It's just one coordinate x in a 6n dimensional space. And the probability distribution on the phase space is rho of x. And now imagine I have two observables, f of x and g of x. So every observable is a function on the phase space, just like any observable is something that has to do with the Hilbert space. And what is the expectation value of f of x? Is the integral of f of x, rho x, in dx. And what is the expectation value of gx? Is the same integral with gx, but with the same probability distribution. You see, there is one underlying probability distribution of the points of the phase space that are real, they are there, and this probability distribution is the same for all the observables. You see, it is not what makes things quantum, is not that you have a probabilistic theory. Here I have a probabilistic theory. I'm saying, you know, what the position of my system, where is in my phase space, is given by probability distribution. Okay, so this is completely, it's a classical probabilistic theory. Now, what happens when I measure B? Okay, so A and B play the role of F and G. Well, what is the probability of the outcome I when in the same state, not in another state? So I'm not changing rho. Rho describes my system. Psi 1 describes my system. In the same state, I measure B. I will have the modulus square in psi 1 of phi I B. And these overlaps, these modulus squares, need not be the same. See, they're different. So you see, we cannot associate to a quantum state one probability distribution. But the probability distribution associated to a quantum state depends on what we look at. In classical physics, the probability distribution is there, it's the same no matter what we look at. If I look at A, I have a probability distribution, and if I look at B, I have another probability distribution that can be completely incompatible. In fact, let's ask, is there some case in which these two happen to be the same probability distribution, like in the classical case? So in general, they don't need to be the same. But let's say I want to solve this equation. Can I have a solution of this equation? You know. When?
When they commute?
Yes, when they commute.
When they're simultaneously dying.
Very good. Because when A and B commute, then the eigenstates of B are the eigenstates of A. So this means that suddenly this becomes this when they commute, and I get the equivalence. You see? It's the same thing. So now you see what is the essence of the quantum theory. The essence of quantum theory is that there are incompatible observables. And incompatible observables, which is this mathematical thing that they do not commute, means that the probability distributions that you obtain when you make these measurements are different. The probability of the outcome I is determined not by the what just solely but what the state is, but what you look at. So there is not an underlying real probability distribution that is there independently of what you are looking at. Okay. So you see, this is really an essential part of quantum mechanics. bear with me just one more minute. So now we have a problem, because if I want to use this definition, so I want to say, oh, my the distance between the probability distribution given by psi 1 and the probability distribution given by psi 2, I would like this to be the cosine to the minus 1. And then I would like to have the sum over all the outcomes and then I take the square root of these probabilities, of the product of these probabilities, right? So I would like to have psi 1 phi ia square. And now, you know, I'm taking the square root in the end, so let me take this away, times the other one, psi 2, phi I A. So this is what I can do. However, this is not the distance between psi 1 and psi 2. It's the distance when I measure A. Right? Because it depends explicitly from A. Unfortunately, it seems that I have a distance between quantum states different depending on what I measure. Okay, but now what we said before comes to rescue. What I choose to measure is a little bit like the set of events that I chose to look at. Right? If I look at the observable A, I discriminate these two states a little bit. But maybe there is a better observable B that takes very different values on these two states, and that will help me discriminate more. So in fact, I can define the distance between psi 1 and psi 2 as the max over all my measurements, over all my observables, of all these distances. So the max here. That is, I say that the distance between two states is when I get to the most discriminating measurement, the corresponding statistical distance. Just like when you want to see if two decks are different, two decks of cards, you know, you don't look just at the full house, but maybe you look at the having four aces to discriminate that they were different. Now, typically maximizing over, you know, the space of Hermitian operators is a very daunting task. However, in this case, it is easy because we know that these overlaps are upper bounded by one, right? Because these are normalized states. So this means that a way to maximize this overlap is to have that one of them is one. If they're both one, means that you have the same probability distribution. But if, because this means that this state is identical to this state, but also this state is identical to this state, so they're identical. But I can maximize by choosing that one of these overlaps is one, which means that A as this form is A1, the projector on psi 1, or psi 2, let me pick psi 1, plus other orthogonal terms. So you see, every Hermitian operator of this form will get to the maximum of this formula. If I plug this, this means that phi 1a is this one. So if I plug this in here, here I get 1. The other terms are orthogonal. So this becomes just cosine to the minus 1 of the modulus of psi 2, psi 1. The overlap, the modulus of the overlap, which is called quantum fidelity. I'll come to your question in a second. Enough of a second. Yeah.
So in the example of pure state, just the scalar inner product of two states.
Yeah. So I was talking about pure states. Now these things can be generalized to mixed states, and what you get instead of the overlap, you get something very similar, which as an exercise, you can show that the so-called Ullmann fidelity, okay, which is this object. It is the trace of the square root. So this is the fidelity between two mixed states. So this generalizes that formula to mixed states. But right now, we're not concerned to this. In the notes, there will be also a section mixed states, but let's stick to, this will take us too far. Yes, this is just the overlap. So now you also understand why the overlap is a measure of distinguishability of states. So this is called the angular distance, right? Because it's the cosine of this angle, of the inner product. Okay, so tomorrow, which means Monday, we will study what happens to this distance when two states are very close to each other, which means that the overlap is almost 1. And we will see that we get to a Riemannian metric tensor. Yes, what is your question?
It's, I don't know how to formulate it, but here we use the distance analogous to what we said, that we could define, for a given set S, the set S, we could define the difference between the probabilities and maximize over S. So isn't, you said this is really not classical, but could there be a way of saying, oh, but A and B are not on the same set of points, so that's why we, and the probability I'm looking at, it's not for the same variables, and so there still would be a classical analog.
No, I mean, they are in the same Hilbert space. So the analogy here is that, if you use S, you extract some information, some partial information of your underlying probability distribution. And when you measure A, you extract only some part of the information about your psi 1, about your system, and psi 2. So,
my question more, if my states, my constant state had an underlying classical distribution, it could be on a very large, let's say a very large set of variables, so that each observable corresponds to one set S of this huge amount of variables for.
Yeah. So I think I understand where you are going. My honest answer is I don't know. So I know that there are people that investigate the possibility that you can somehow reconstruct this quantum behavior by having only one underlying probability distribution, and then okay, you are only sampling it in the wrong way when you look at some observables. and that's why you get different probability distributions. So I don't know to what extent showing that you can actually do that and that that reproduces all the possible things in quantum mechanics, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that. My personal point of view is that it is very complicated, whereas algebra is very easy. And I don't see the point of explaining something with something very complicated when it can be explained very easily, just because you think that having incompatible measurements is a sin. Because I think that it boils down to that. I think it's actually very interesting that there are incompatible things in the world. But of course, my colleagues that do quantum foundations now will grill me for this. I'm not saying that they are wrong. I'm saying that we have a different morality. We see what is sinful in a different way. Okay, so jokes apart. So we will see that how this can become a Riemannian metric tensor, and then we will apply it to the quantum phase transitions that we know, and we'll see that it actually works. Okay.